All right, and tonight our topic is kind of the nature of science. Still sort of in this first section, kind of just since we're talking about faith and science, talking about sort of defining each term and then the deal. So big picture, we are exploring the topic of science and faith, and particularly how the two sort of interface with each other, and we're just now getting started. We began by acknowledging 2 weeks ago that there is a perception, and I would use the term perception, that there's a conflict, fundamental contact exists between science and faith. And you know, there are many books out there that make that argument. Last week, as we looked at the issue of faith, or this relationship from the faith side, we took a look at aspects of our faith that are relevant for the science and faith relationship. In other words, what is it that faith brings to the science-faith relationship? Specifically, we just lifted up three things. I'm just going to just mention them. First is the belief that there is a spiritual dimension to life. In other words, that there's more to life and there's more to the universe than the material. And there's more to being human than just wires or chemicals. Both of those arguments are made by some, that all there is to existence is the material, or all there is to being human is just wires and chemicals. Our faith argues, no, there's more to life than that. Because of that, we have in the last, at least since the Enlightenment, used language like transcendent, metaphysical, supernatural, the trans, the meta, the super, all implying more. There's more than just the material. This term that the Bible uses and the term that our faith is used more often is the term the spiritual. We're going to use the term spiritual in this series because I think it's a more appropriate term, because the supernatural stuff like that sort of implies sort of a false dichotomy that the faith would say really is not there. The second thing we looked at was that we can know about spiritual things through a form of knowledge known as revelation. And traditionally, revelation falls into two broad categories. One is natural revelation, which is kind of the heavens declare the glory of God, as the Psalms would say. In other words, that through nature, we get some insight, not total, but some insight into the spiritual world and into God. So from creation, we imply creator. From design, we imply designer. And then the second is called special revelation, which is the area of scripture and is the area of the Holy Spirit, that there's some things that we will never learn through nature, but that our faith shares with us. The third thing we looked at was that behind everything that we see and experience, that we do believe there is a being, a God, that is at play, who is the source of everything, sustains everything, and who's directing the universe to a larger purpose. So those three things are kind of what faith brings to the science-faith relationship. There's more than the material. There's a spiritual dimension to life. We can know that through two types of revelation, and that behind that we believe there is a God at play. Tonight we want to turn to the other half of the relationship, which is to the realm of science, and ask kind of two things. Not only what is science, because you probably know there's a lot of confusion out there about that, even to some degree within the scientific community. But also, the other question is whether there is anything in science itself that is in conflict with the core affirmations of faith. You probably already know, my answer to that is a firm and resounding no. Our discipline, the Methodist discipline, also says that, but we want to take a critical look at that. Start with the obvious. Modern science is the greatest success story in human history. Over the last four centuries, since roughly the mid-1600s, modern science has transformed our lives, and it's transformed the world that we're a part of. It has fundamentally altered how we understand the universe and reality that we're a part of. Science has consistently been able to successfully describe how the universe works, and it's done so in ways that have immense practical benefits. I mean, you just look at this picture. If you have a modern car, I mean, it's just full of the benefits of science and technology, as is the technology that we're using tonight to talk to each other. No aspect of our lives has been left untouched by modern science and technology. You just run the table with it. Now, one result of this success is the emergence of something known as the scientific worldview. This is a way of looking at the world that literally shapes how we perceive the world. Modern people, generally speaking, view the world through a scientific lens, and that lens kind of tells us what is real, what is not, what is possible, what is not. You know, what's possible and how we can arrive at what we know. This has resulted, and among other things, it's resulted in a lot of good things, but it has resulted in some common myths about science. And we need to put these on the table because they're relevant to our discussion. These are myths that are very prevalent in our culture. Even some people within the scientific community may hear use some of this language. For example, you have likely heard at some point statements like scientific proof or scientific truth. Or maybe you've even heard the claim that you can scientifically prove that something is true. That's out there a lot. There's a lot of people making that statement. Now, what's interesting is, of course, is that all of this language about, you know, about truth and proof and scientific, you know, all that is based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of science. I'm going to take it down a piece at a time. Here's the first myth. That science is concerned with proving things. This is not a minor point, but it strikes at the very heart of what science is and what science is not. In 2011, you may know this story, the respected scientific magazine known as Science got into some very public trouble over precisely this issue. Science magazine ran an article about the Gravity Probe B satellite. Here's a diagram of it, and this is what's referred to as frame dragging. You may remember back in the 1920s, there was a very famous experiment during a total eclipse where the stars were shifted. The stars, as they normally are shifted to a different position behind the moon or behind the sun because of the intense gravity of the sun. And at that time, that was considered the first really great proof of Einstein's theory of general relativity. In a very similar kind of way, the Earth is not as big as the sun, but the Earth's gravity, now we've got better instruments, can actually frame drag or shift the position of stars, indicating, again, that Einstein's theory was true. All of that's just pure science, well accepted. But here's what the magazine said. At long last, Gravity Probe B satellite proves Einstein right. So here is one of the premier science magazines in the world using the word proves. And it got out there. Charles Bennett, astronomer, physicist, Johns Hopkins University, wrote a really irate letter to the editor of the magazine. This is what he said. The article made me cringe. I find myself frequently repeating to students and to the public that science does not prove theories. This resulted in a formal retraction. Colin Norman, the editor of Science magazine, admitted, and I quote, "Bennett is completely correct. It is an important conceptual point, and we blew it." So even in the scientific community, sometimes this language gets out there. Now, why is this important? It's because science operates with a particular methodology, and the methodology is not of proving things, but exactly the opposite. The methodology of science proceeds by what is called falsification. The goal of science is not to prove something, but to disprove it. Throw everything you can at it, attack it from every direction you can, and see if your theory or your hypothesis can stand up to the test. So in science, you seek evidence that refutes. wonderful little story I thought you might appreciate. This is known as the white swan problem. So I just want to kind of walk you through this. This is well known in the scientific community. Take the hypothesis. All swans are white. We want to put that argument out there. We want to approach it scientifically. Since science uses the methodology of empirical observation, observation is the source of all of our data. Okay, let's say that every swan you have ever seen in your life is white. For me, that would be true. And every swan anybody else you know has seen is white. And maybe you've talked to people in different places and you've done a lot of research and you've accumulated a vast amount of data, all of which says that every single swan that anybody's ever seen is white. Okay, this is observational empirical data. It is clear, it's consistent. Why is that a problem? Well, here's the problem. You can never accumulate enough observational data through inductive logic, you know, observing things and piecing together, to prove that all swans are white. Thomas Huxley famously put it this way: every beautiful theory is just one ugly fact away from being disproven. Here's a picture of your ugly fact. In southern Australia, near Perth, you can find black swans. No matter how many white swans you see, you can never prove that all swans are white, but a single piece of data, one black swan, can prove the claim false. Interesting story, humorous, but it strikes at the heart of the nature of science. This is known as the principle of falsification. Science looks for evidence that can disprove hypotheses. When the hypothesis survives all attempts to disprove it, it can advance to a theory. We'll get more of that in just a minute. As a result, scientific knowledge is always provisional. All scientific knowledge, whether it's hypothesis or theories, is only one fact or one observation away from being falsified. Some of you may know Karl Popper, very famous 20th century scientist. He was also a philosopher of science, wrote extensively on what science is, what science is not. His major work was called The Logic of Scientific Discovery. This is an observation he makes. Science cannot prove anything. I am always surprised at just how controversial such a matter-of-fact statement is to some people. It is impossible for science to prove anything because science is based on experiments and observations, all of which could be flawed. Scientific measurements can only disprove theories or be consistent with them. Any theory that is consistent with measurements could be disproved by a future measurement. A second common myth is that science is concerned about truth. This is Neil Gerson, who's director of the MIT Center Bidson Adams. The most common misunderstanding about science is that scientists seek and find the truth. They don't. They make and test models. Building models is a very different thing from proclaiming truths. Science involves the never-ending process of discovery and refinement. Now, the problem with scientific truth is not only is it a misnomer, an oxymoron, but it's an oxymoron built from two terms, neither which can be applied to science. But that language is out there. Even Science Magazine tripped up on that. Science can never say that anything is true. Truth is about certainty. Science is about questioning and opening. That's why science is not about truth. Carlo Rovelli, quantum physicist at CERN in Switzerland with the big collider. A good scientist is never certain. If better elements of evidence or novel arguments emerge, the good scientist will always be ready to shift to a different point of view. Now, if science is not about truth, and science is not about proving anything, then what is science? Simply put, science is at its essence a methodology. It's a way of doing something. It's a way of observing the natural world and trying to make sense of what is seen. It studies the order that is found in nature, and it does so by the use of empirical or sensory evidence. We refer to that as data. The motto of science, going back to the 1600s, is nullus in verba, on no one's word. In other words, for science, you know, we're not going to take somebody's word that something is the case, whether that word is from a respected source such as Aristotle or from the Bible, speaking scientifically. Instead, science seeks to verify all statements by an appeal to data that are determined by experiment. This means that the claims of science, and this gets into the politics of some of the stuff that's going on now, the claims of science are not random, arbitrary, or capricious. They are not based on what we feel, what we think, or what we believe. Scientific statements, scientific claims are backed up by evidence, by observations, by warrants, reasons, and by the data. Science operates through something called the scientific method. Just a quick sidebar here. There are some people who today say that the scientific method doesn't actually exist. That's going too far. But the scientific method, I want to lay out for you, is not a straitjacket that science has to jump through. It's a loose set of guidelines and principles. But it still, in essence, still works today. So here's a graph on the right, a little chart. Science begins with observation of the sensory empirical world. That might be through a microscope, through a telescope, watching a sunset, could be any different ways, but begins by looking at nature. Then it uses reason to ask questions about what is observed. You know, why is that so? You know, how does that work? What's that about? Especially about things that do not make sense. You see something in nature and you say, I don't know how that works. Reason is then used to create a hypothesis. Now, all a hypothesis is, fancy word, but it's merely a tentative, possible idea, a possible explanation of how to explain what we observed. We don't know that it's true, but it's a shot. We're going to see if this might work. One that could possibly answer the questions that arise from the observation. That's all a hypothesis is. It's a shot. Then we devise and carry out experiments to test the hypothesis. If my hypothesis is true, what would that look like? Or actually more, what could I do to show that that's not true? In your experiments, you're going to throw everything you can at the hypothesis trying to falsify it. Because again, you can't prove it. You can never have enough data to prove. So only one piece of data could disprove it. What might that be? Use that as your tactic. When it comes to the data that results from the experiments, there are only two possibilities, two major ones. Either like this young man in the chemistry lab, the data shows that the theory hypothesis is false. It blows up in your face. You find a black swan and your theory needs to be abandoned. Well, that was a great theory, but it met an ugly fact. Or more likely, what really happens most often in science is you don't abandon the theory, but you tweak it. You begin to refine it a little bit. Well, that's not true. Well, what about this? What if I change it a little bit here? Again, as Thomas Huxley famously put it, many beautiful theory fallen prey to an ugly fact. The other possibility, though, is that the data is consistent with the theory or with the hypothesis. Now, if all of the data supports the hypothesis, if we've done everything we can to falsify it, to refute it, and cannot, we are on the first step of a long journey towards what is called an accepted theory. Now, there will be always be anomalies. There will be observations, phenomena that are not explained by the theory. And this may cause the cycle to start over. We refine the hypothesis. We devise new experiments. We get new data. And, you know, this may have several incarnations. What it does, though, is it results in the refining of the theory or the refining of the hypothesis. And an old theory may bite the dust in light of new findings. But when you do that, you're not done. You're just beginning. The next step in the scientific method involves the professional community. Science is not done by lone individuals working in isolation. Now, it could be that a scientist may have a great insight, a great breakthrough on their own, but that's never a scientific. You have this second step. Science is done within a scientific community of your peers. Science is collective. It is collaborative. It's corroborative with multiple people making contributions. It involves experiments that can be repeated by other scientists. If you have a result and other people cannot repeat it, doing what you did and get the same results, you're in trouble. Scientists share data, they write papers, they publish in journals, they attend conferences. Scientists have to grapple with criticism, adjust their views in light of any new evidence. It could be that their experiment data cannot be replicated. Okay, that's an issue. Or somebody finds something different. That's an issue. You have to deal with that. The goal of all this is to arrive at a consensus within the community. This is a process known as peer review. Now, here's a chart. You have an idea, a theory, hypothesis, this great insight. You create the experiments, you do the research, you write it up, and by the way, the research here may take years and lots of false starts, but eventually you get it to the point where, I think I've got something here. I write it up. I propose an article. It's a manuscript. I send it to the journal editor. It's going to be reviewed by 3 to 5 experts in the field, and they can decide, this is something that we need to get out there for everybody to look at. Decision is made to accept it, reject it, or very often to revise it. Kick it back to the author. You need to polish this a little bit. Now, once the research is published, other scientists see if the results can be replicated and corroborated. This is how they find out. They read the articles. They read the research. Oh, we have a cure for the COVID-19 virus. Well, do we? And by the way, this is what's going on right now with all these different places around the world. They've got some viruses that the initial results look really good. But right now, all of these things, they're trying to determine, one, will it be effective against the virus? Two, will it not kill you itself? Is it, can you spread it? And then run that through it. So it's in that process right now. Now, if the research is corroborated by the cumulative evidence of the community, if we have a scientific consensus is reached, as with the COVID-19 vaccine, it is now make billions of it and kick it out there. But we're still not talking about proof. What we have is a theory, and the theory, at least temporarily, is good enough. Does it work? Now, just a sidebar here. There is nothing in any of this that is remotely in conflict with faith or our core beliefs. Just put that on the table. Nothing of what I've shared with you threatens the faith or in any way is in tension with the faith. Now, there's also a second methodology that is used in science today. One that is used by Newton. It was used by James Clerk Maxwell in the electromagnetic theory. Einstein, Stephen Hawking, and many, many others. This form of science is not empirical. It does not use the methodology of experimentation. Yet it has resulted in some of the greatest breakthroughs in science. The second approach is known simply as pure mathematics. Later in this series, we're going to have an entire session to explore this aspect of science in detail because it's a wonderful part of science. But for now, we're going to limit our discussion to empirical science, experimentation. This brings us to the third myth about science. This is the one that is most relevant for the discussion of the relationship between faith and science. It's simply this. Some hold the belief, this is the myth, that science can answer every question or that science can solve every problem. It can't. And any real scientist knows that. Science was never intended to answer all questions or to solve every problem. Science was designed to make sense of nature, the natural order, to explain how the world around us actually works. The method of science means that there are clear limits to what science can do. Scientific knowledge is limited. It is limited to the empirical, to the sensory, to the material. Not all questions are scientific. Not all questions have empirical answers. This is well known in science that science cannot tell us why the universe exists. Why is not an empirical question. It is not a scientific question. Why are we here? Why is anything here? Why does suffering exist? Questions like these lie outside the realm of scientific endeavor. They are not empirical. This is important to understand because it means that science cannot deal with things that lie beyond the domain of science. Science cannot deal, by definition, with the non-empirical. Therefore, the meta, the trans, the super, the spiritual, God, revelation, the domain of religion, the domain of meaning. This is not the domain of science. In spite of the claims by some, science cannot deny a metaphysical or a spiritual reality. Science cannot deny God. You cannot prove, oxymoron, that God doesn't exist without lapsing into metaphysics or ideology itself, which by definition, science cannot do. It is faith, the realm of faith, that deals with the realm of meaning. It is faith and the realm of faith that deals with the why questions. So how does the method of science interface with religion and faith? Because it is limited to the empirical, science in principle and by definition should not infringe on faith and religion. They operate in different realms. Conversely, though, the how questions about the mechanics of the universe are not the realm of faith. Galileo made a famous quip he's actually quoting a Catholic archbishop, but he famously quipped this, and it's become sort of a standard statement. Faith is about how to get to heaven, not about how the heavens go. Saying there that faith is one realm, science is another realm, don't confuse the two. Augustine, last week, you remember, we had that long quote by him. He talked about it's disgraceful and it's dangerous for people of faith to sort of waltz over into the realm of science and start making claims about stuff they don't know anything about. This is even acknowledged by the National Academy of Sciences. This is a statement on the website of the National Academy of Science. It's a statement on religion and science. This is their official position. And I quote, "Religion and science answer different questions about the world. Whether there is a purpose to the universe or a purpose to human existence, these are not questions for science. Science is a way of knowing about the natural world, It is limited to explaining the natural world through natural causes. Science can say nothing about the supernatural. Whether God exists is not a question science can answer. Now, this has even been acknowledged by some of the most preeminent scientists in history. Just give you a few examples here. Werner Heisenberg, one of the great pioneers in quantum physics, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, made this comment. I've never found it possible to dismiss the content of religious thinking as simply part of an outmoded phase of the consciousness of mankind, a part that we shall have to give up from now on. Thus, in the course of my life, I've been repeatedly compelled to ponder on the relationship of these two regions of thought, for I've never been able to doubt the reality of that to which they both point. So, one of the great pioneers, he has no problem with faith. This raises a question, though. If science and faith are so different, something that science itself acknowledges, then why are science and religion so often perceived, that's the word, perceived as being in conflict? The answer lies in what are known as boundary violations. Conflict can emerge when either science or faith cross over into the realm of the other and start making claims. As in when people of faith make scientific claims based on religious belief. Claims like the sun revolves around the earth. Like the world was created in seven literal days, 4004 BC. Dinosaurs lived with humans. On the other hand, we can also have a conflict when people of science make religious, philosophical, or ideological claims based on science. Claims like that the only valid knowledge is empirical, that science is incompatible with religion, that religion is a form of mental illness, that God is a delusion. These are all statements that have been made by some scientists, but they are not remotely scientific statements. They are not empirical. They're not based on data. They are actually ideology. They are opinions. They are views, but put out there as science. Science and faith may not be in conflict, and I would argue they are not, period. But if members of either community make claims that cross over into the realm of the other, conflict can and will occur. So next week, we're going to explore how this happens from the side of the scientific community, and then after that, we'll pick up the religious community. We're going to turn to something called naturalism. You may have heard it, another title, materialism. So next week, naturalism and the perception of conflict between science and faith.